Welcome back to the program. Maybe it says something about the state of urban history today, but to better understand the history and culture of our two great California cities, San Francisco and Los Angeles, we need to go back to the 1930s and look at two volumes produced by the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, at the height of the Depression, to truly capture the beauty and authenticity of L.A. and San Francisco. Add to these volumes an introduction by former San Francisco Chronicle book critic David Kippen, and you truly have more than a passing vision of a time gone by. David Kippen served for 5 years as the Director of Literature at the National Endowment for the Arts, where he led the Big Read Initiative, and for 7 years was book editor and book critic at the San Francisco Chronicle. He also now operates a bookstore and lending library in Los Angeles entitled Libro Schmibros. It is my pleasure to welcome David Kippen here to talk about the republishing and his introduction of these two volumes of the WPA, the WPA Guide to the City of Los Angeles and the WPA Guide to the City by the Bay. David Kippen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a treat to talk with you, Jeff.
Great to have you here. Talk about these volumes and how they evolved in the 1930s and really what the deal was with the WPA and keeping writers busy during that period.
Well, not just busy, but productive. I mean, that was always the knock on the New Deal and the NRA under Roosevelt, that it was just make work. But you only have to look at these two volumes, let alone the other hundreds of them created by the Federal Writers Project, to see that, you know, this was necessary and useful and you know, eminently readable work even 70 years later. The idea was that it wasn't I mean, when we think of the WPA and the New Deal, we think of bridge building and road building and trailblazing and all these wonderful necessary projects that Roosevelt and his associates created. But of course, it wasn't just bridge builders and stonemasons who were out of work. It was writers. And so they set aside a little money to put writers to work. And the first and biggest project that they found for them was to create these state guides, guides to then all 48 states. And the California Guide, which has been out of print since the 1980s, is one of the very glories of this project. But once, after several years, they had all the state guides done, they realized that there was still work to be done. And so they looked around and started to create these city guides, very few of which, unlike the state guides, some of which have come back into print, have seen prints in the 70 years since they were published. And two of the glories of them, as luck would have it, are Los Angeles and San Francisco.
And these are more than just small guides to the city. I mean, let's give our listeners a sense of how extensive these are.
Well, you're talking about guides of 400 or 500 pages each, with extensive explorations of the history and the byways and the architecture. They're lavishly illustrated guides with some terrific photographers at work whose names I think readers would recognize even today. Edward Weston, Julia Shulman took pictures for the Federal Writers Project or their allied project, the Farm Service Administration, and those found their way into these guides. They're road tours. Some of the roads are harder to find now, in the same way that anybody's ever tried to retrace the path of, say, Route 66 has kind of a patchwork job in front of them. But to me, that's part of the adventure. You're trying to recapture a time 70 years ago, and in those instances where the scenery hasn't changed very much, it's a testament to how good we've been at preserving our past. And, of course, in those, I think, arguably more numerous instances where a building has been torn down or a hillside has been developed, it becomes a challenge to us, you know, to be a little more vigilant in preserving our great legacy as Californians, or asking ourselves, you know, what's lost and what's gained in these trade-offs we've made over the intervening 7 decades.
And the other side of that is that had these guides been around, come back into print earlier, it might have preserved some of these buildings. It might have reminded people of their place in history.
Yeah, and there was an attempt to republish the San Francisco Guide in the early 1960s, but it went back out of print, I think, within a year or two. What the University of California Press has done with these guides is publish them so lovingly with gorgeous covers and, you know, a really respectful treatment of, you know, the very expert typography and you know, book arts that went into them, is create monuments to the California of the late 1930s and, you know, so much of which still persists around us, that I don't think they're going back out of print anytime soon.
There is also a certain authenticity to this that you don't find it in kind of more contemporary descriptions of some of these places, even the ones still around.
Well, no, I mean, you know, in a way you're looking not just at a snapshot of California 70 years ago, you're looking at a snapshot of prose as it was written, in the case especially of the San Francisco book, brilliantly written. No coincidence, because the great San Francisco Renaissance poet Kenneth Rexroth was one of the writers who kept body and soul together by working on these guides. You know, and in some cases you're looking at attitudes preserved from 70 years ago that, you know, maybe we're not so proud of anymore, and yet no one would want to retouch that or airbrush it out of existence. I mean, I live, as you mentioned, in this low-income, working-class neighborhood of Los Angeles called Boyle Heights, where I run my little lending library, and it's described in the words of the guide 70 years ago as a neighborhood teeming with Jews and Mexicans. Which we don't have quite enough Jews to field a team anymore. I'm about the only one, but you know, this is not a phrase I think that would pass editorial muster nowadays. And yet, you know, there's nothing, you know, insidious about it. It's sort of benign and clueless, and that too, I think, becomes part of the fun of these books.
Also, in the Guide to the City by the Bay, talking about San Francisco as a city sort of devoid of landmarks and anything noteworthy.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I sort of picked up on in the introduction. I mean, it's not like the book wants for loving descriptions of this, of the built and natural Bay Area landscape, but when you open a book 2 years after the completion of the San Francisco Bay Bridge and you come across a line that goes, and I'm approximating here, something like, San Francisco does not have any single one landmark emblematic of the landscape, it tells you that the Bay Bridge, you know, was not, you know, instantly accepted as one of the glories of modern architecture the world over. This was something that had to gradually, you know, make its way into our lives to the point where now, of course, the visual vocabulary of the Bay Area is just impossible to talk about without it.
Is there a danger with any of this of over-romanticizing some of this stuff from the past?
Well, as a freelance writer today, I have to tell you, Jeff, it's kind of hard to over-romanticize an era when your work was so prized by your own government that they were willing to pay you, not overpay you, but at least give you a pittance to ply your trade. At the same time, yeah, of course. I mean, you're talking about a program created precisely to enable Americans to feed themselves and clothe themselves at a time when, you know, the unemployment rate was you know, double or even triple what it is today. So nobody wants to see the 1930s come back. I think, you know, you've only to look around you to see some instances in which it threatens to come back, and it's altogether alarming. But I think it's very possible to look back not just wistfully, but with determination to see how we can apply the lessons of the 1930s. And, you know, make, you know, these two cities, the state of California, the country, a better place, not just for writers, but for, you know, Americans from coast to coast.
It also creates, particularly the L.A. book, a sense of optimism in a way, because you really get a sense, no matter how bad things might be today, a sense of the boom and bust cycles.
Very definitely. And you know, certainly San Francisco is no stranger to booms and busts because of its, you know, great, you know, surrounding mineral wealth over the years. I mean, this is one of the things that I picked up on when the UC Press gave me the great honor of assigning me these two introductions, not just the similarities between the guides, because, of course, they were created by the same federal agency, but the differences. You know, the San Francisco in the 1930s, I think I have to confess, the WPA Guide to San Francisco is the better written book, partly, in fact, because of the participation of Rexroth, who I think wrote some of these essays or rewrote some of these essays when they came in from less distinguished writers. The Los Angeles book is one that we pick up less for the quality of the prose, although it's quite good, as for the snapshot of the city in 1939. I mean, San Francisco has such an illustrious history. You know, I think if you asked people if they could go in a time machine to any moment in San Francisco's past, you'd probably get answers all over the map. But if you asked people what moment in Los Angeles history they might like to return to, certainly if you asked writers, they would say the moment exactly at which this book was being prepared, 1939, the time that Raymond Chandler was writing the first of the Philip Marlowe novels, The Big Sleep, the time that Nathaniel West was writing The Day of the Locust, the great Hollywood novel. John Fonte was writing Ask the Dust. You're talking about a moment in film history when one guy, Victor Fleming, was shooting or reshooting two movies which I think persist among the handful of most beloved American movies of all time, Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz. Orson Welles had just come west from New York, where he was working very successfully in the theater and on radio, to start thinking about how to top those successes in the movie that eventually became Citizen Kane. I mean, Los Angeles was an amazing place, in part because so many people had come there from other very depressed parts of the country and were guiltily, although I think you'd have to say pretty ecstatically, doing the work of their lives.
And to what extent does the writing in the City of Angels guide kind of reflect that?
Well, the only name I think you would recognize today, if you were even a film buff, of the contributors to the Los Angeles Guide is a guy named Carl Foreman, who 10 or 20 years later would be writing great screenplays like High Noon and Bridge on the River Kwai, and a few years after that would sadly be blacklisted and have to flee to Europe. There were great advisors on the guide. Kerry McWilliams, the great California historian based in Southern California, is one of the names mentioned who worked on it. As with the San Francisco guide, one of the advisors, although not the authors, was a guy named Joseph Henry Jackson, who had my old job at the San Francisco Chronicle as book critic from 1935 to 1955, where he had the distinction of just about discovering John Steinbeck. So, the writing of these guides is emblematic, not just of the writers themselves, who all too often go uncredited or credited in the introduction where it's anybody's pigeon who wrote what, but, it's this wonderful sort of, exercise in group consciousness. There is, an individual voice behind each of these essays, and it's kind of fun to speculate and even research if you've got the time and try and figure, match the voice with the writers we know worked on them. And yet at the same time, especially in San Francisco, you get a sense of the city itself talking to you, the city itself bragging, as San Franciscans are sometimes prone to do, but also cracking jokes because it's absolutely an uproariously funny guide in places.
You also get a sense of what has continued to grow up in terms of mythology more than anything else, but the difference between these two cities and why some of the things that are emblematic of both of them have sort of grown up the way they have.
Yeah, there was an interesting review of the two guides by, I think, a native Angeleno long resident in San Francisco by the name of Shaw, who writes for BeyondCrom.com. And he said the big difference between these two guides is how much of San Francisco from 1940 is left and how much of Los Angeles from 1940 is gone. And I got off a line in the L.A. guide, which turns out in the course of, the reviews of the book that have run over the years, to be the most quoted, which is kind of bittersweet for me because it's a rather dispiriting line. I say if there is a WPA guide to a more vanished American city, beats me what it is. Mm. I meant that when I wrote it. I wrote it in a longer essay, and I'd hate to think that people's takeaway from this book is, what a completely disappeared city the Los Angeles of 70 years ago was, because, of course, the cover image of the book, the Union Station, the great passenger rail terminal, the last of the great passenger rail terminals, something San Francisco, alas, can't quite claim, is still, in its glory and about to recapture a kind of primacy in Californians' lives it hadn't had before, because, of course, they're working on high-speed rail, which is going to bring all my San Francisco friends down to Los Angeles in 2.5 hours within a decade, we hope, and vice versa.
The other thing is that we are in a time when I think there is greater appreciation of this history, particularly in Los Angeles. Had this come out 15, 20 years ago, I don't think it would be received quite the same way.
I think you're right. There are a couple of writers, Lionel Rolfe, who wrote Literary L.A., Robert Winter, who over the 5 editions or so has been writing a book called The Guide to Los Angeles Architecture. These are guys who have gradually given Los Angeles the kind of self-awareness, for those people who care to look, that San Francisco really had the lead on for a long time. And partly, I think that's because of, the way publishing in California has gone. You've got this, I think it's safe to say, one of the two major presses in California. Well, both of them, in fact, are based in Berkeley. One is Heyday, the great regional publisher run by Malcolm Margolin, and the other is UC Press, which, you know, blessedly has brought these two wonderful guys back in print. Well, they're both in Berkeley. You know, there's no comparable institution, sadly, although, you know, certainly some scrappy, contenders for the title in Southern California. And so, yes, inevitably, the written history of the landscape of the state has been sadly skewed toward Northern California. And yes, in recent years, more and more, as we see, the contributions of a really great regional editor, like the woman who brought these back into print, Kim Robinson, you're starting to see, you know, equal attention paid to other parts of the state beyond just California.
And with respect to the Bay Area and the writing in that, talk a little bit about that, because as you mentioned before, and I want to expand on that a little bit, some of the really great writers that have been a part of Bay Area history.
You know, some of the affection for the Bay Area, especially its natural features, because, of course, there are these driving tours. One of the things the WPA guides were not so secretly designed to do was stimulate the economy. And one way to do that was to get people to buy gasoline, put in their old Flivvers and Oldsmobiles, and get out on the open road and explore the terrain around them. And so you've got these wonderful descriptions. They don't get up quite as far as Napa, but I did take the liberty, let me see if I've still got it here, of looking up in the California State Guide, which we hope, if these books sell well enough, UC Press will also bring back into print. There, you know, there's a wonderful description of your neck of the woods. Listen to this. Let's see. Bale Mill, built in 1846 by the English settler Dr. Edward Bale, nephew-in-law of General Mariano Vallejo, and owner of the Carne Humana Rancho, which in parentheses is translated from the Spanish as the Human Flesh Ranch. Does anybody know if there's any remnant out there in Napa County of the Bale Mill, and why on earth someone would want to name a ranch after human flesh? I'll be beholden to your listeners if they want.
Bale Mill is still there.
It is.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Then there's this reference to in St. Helena, the Pacific Union College, which is built in the crater of an extinct volcano. How did I live up in the Bay Area for so long and miss that? I mean, if you can imagine, you know, attention paid to these, you know, obscure byways, or obviously not so obscure if you live right there in the terrain, but even for somebody living 50 miles away, perhaps terra incognita, you can just imagine, what a wonderful window on a lot of, as you pointed out, surviving but overlooked kind of shunpike scenery in both Los Angeles and San Francisco is to be found in the pages of these reissues.
Did you have an opportunity in putting these together and doing the research on it to look at city guides from other places around the country that they had done?
I have not. I mean, I'm sort of a WPA buff,
right.
But, you know, WPA scholarship is sadly not what it might be. Maybe as the country, you know, flirts with economic peril again, I won't feel quite so lonely in my obsession with them. I've been trying to collect as many of the 48 state guides as possible. The city guides, I have hardly any of besides San Francisco and Los Angeles, which, of course, have been the focus of my attention for the last year or so. There were wonderful other guides written about other cities in California, which I'm starting to know a little bit because, of course, as I say, if these books take off the way they're starting to, there may be a chance to republish those, too. San Diego got a guide. It's not nearly as long as these two guides, but it's about 150 pages. There are guides to natural features as well. There's a WPA guide to the Monterey Peninsula, which also, of course, delves into the area's history and built landscape. There's a guide to Death Valley, written by WPA staff. There's even a guide entirely written by Kenneth Rexroth, which has never been published, not even right after it was written, because the WPA, of course, was red-baited out of existence in the 1940s. This is a guide to hiking in the Sierra. I've glanced at it. The prose is unmistakably Rexroth. It is very useful in a way that, you know, undercuts some of his more poetic flights, because he's telling you how to tie a double half hitch in a tent that won't fall down in a storm. But that's a book that, you know, I think is a logical republication candidate not too long from now, because this is a book they don't have to republish. It was never actually set in type in the first place.
Somehow I'm trying to get my head around the idea of these books from 1939 being published online at some point.
Well, in fact, I probably shouldn't mention this because some of your listeners may be inclined to look it up online rather than buying these beautiful volumes, but there's an outfit called the Prelinger Library in San Francisco that is starting to put them online and searchable. I'm not sure how well they work on a mobile phone, and they certainly wouldn't be much company for a road trip. But, yeah, I mean, these are books that the taxpayers paid for in the first place. And so they're ours. I think we have to, you know, we owe a great debt of gratitude to University of California Press for putting them in a format that can ride around in our panniers and our glove compartments today. But for heaven's sake, they're ours. They're our birthright. I think I ran a program for the National Endowment for the Arts called The Big Read, where you try and get everybody in a city or town reading the same book at the same time for a month, so they have something more interesting in common to talk about than the weather. And I can't think of a better candidate for city reads, for bringing a community together around a book and starting fascinating conversations about what's changed over 70 years, what hasn't changed, what we might want to think about changing in the future, than these two books and the other shelf full of volumes like them.
David Kippen, he's written the introduction to the WPA Guides to the City of Angels and the City by the Bay, just out from UC Press. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, Jeff, it's a pleasure. I can't wait to come up and meet you and see a little more of Napa myself sometime.
We'll take you up to Bail Mill.
Yeah, just, you know, let's avoid the human flesh if we can.
Okay. David Kippen, thanks so much.